Thank you, Charlene said and sat back in her throne, laying her forearms along the armrests as she gazed at the men before her. The ballroom's tension crackled higher now that the formalities were out of the way, and she felt the witnesses' focused attention like the rays of the sun captured and concentrated by a magnifying glass. But not quite like the sun, for this focus was cold and sharp as a Cherethe icicle, not fiery. It ought to be fiery, she thought. I ought to feel passionate satisfaction and justification at seeing these men brought to the end they deserve. But it isn't, and I don't. She didn't know precisely what she did feel, and it didn't matter. What mattered was what she had to do. You've heard the charges against you, she said in a voice of ice. All of you have heard the verdicts. All of you have had ample opportunity to see the massive weight of evidence which was brought to bear against each of you. No honest-minded man or woman on the face of this world will ever be able to dispute the proofs of your crimes, and the records of your trials are open to all. Every step of the process which brings you here this day has been in accordance with the law of your own princedom as well as the law of Caris. We will entertain no pleas or protests against the justice of the court which tried you, or of the scrupulous observation of the law, your rights, or the verdicts. If any of you have anything you wish to say before sentence is passed upon you, however, now is the time. Craggy Hill and Stormkeep only glared, helpless fury burning in their eyes. Deep Hollow's facial muscles quivered, although Charlian couldn't have said what emotion woke those spasms. He pressed his lips together without speaking, however, and her eyes moved to black water. The Duke's face was dark with anger and curdled with hate, yet she actually felt a flicker of sympathy in his case. His father's death at Darkos Sound was what had brought him into the conspiracy. At least he had the excuse of honest anger, honest outrage, not solely the cynical ambition which had served Craggy Hill and Deep Hollow. "I wish to speak," Baron Larcross said after a moment, and Charlian nodded to him. "Then do so." "I can't speak for all of my fellows," he replied, raising his chin and looking her in the eye. But I did what I did because I will never acknowledge the authority of the craven lickspittles of this Regency Council of Traitors you and your husband have foisted upon this princedom. It was their willingness to sell themselves to you Carizians for personal power and advantage, not ambition on my part, which brought me to resist them. You may call it treason if you please, but I say the treason was theirs, not mine, and that no man of conscience can be held to any oath sworn to traitors, regicides, heretics, and excommunicates. A stir went through the witnesses, and Charlian gazed back down at him for several seconds without speaking. Then she nodded slowly. "You speak clearly, Baron of Larcross," she said then, "and you speak with courage. You may even speak truthfully of your own motives, and we grant you their sincerity. Yet you did swear the oaths you violated. You did grant your allegiance to the Regency Council, the legally selected Regency Council, chosen by your own parliament, as Prince Davin's representatives and the guardians of his interests and prerogatives here in Coruscant. And you did violate the laws of Coruscant, as well as conspiring to unleash warfare here in the heart of your own princedom. We may concede that you acted out of what you believe to have been the best of motivations. We will not concede that your motivations justify your actions, nor will we retreat one inch from the authority which is ours under the accepted law of nations by right of victory, fairly and openly won upon the field of battle, and by acknowledgement of your own Parliament following that victory. We will say this much. You, more than any of your fellows, have our respect, but respect cannot stay the demands of justice. Lacrosse's jaw clenched. He seemed to hover on the brink of saying something more, but he stopped himself and simply stood meeting her gaze with hot-eyed defiance. "Please, Your Majesty," Barkor said suddenly into the silence. "I was carried away by patriotism and loyalty to Mother Church, I admit it. But as the court itself determined, I was never party to the core of this conspiracy. I—" He broke off as Charlian looked at him with undisguised contempt. His eyes fell, and she smiled coldly. "The fact that cowardice prevented you from openly declaring yourself as Baron Lacrosse did is no defence," she said flatly. "You were prepared to take your share of the spoils when Craggy Hill and Storm Keep divided the new Regency Council between themselves. You preferred to spend gold instead of blood or steel, perhaps, but you cannot separate yourself so easily from the core of this conspiracy. My lord, I told you we would hear no pleas, no protests of innocence. Have you anything further to say?" Barkor's lips trembled. His face was ashen, and his head swiveled, eyes imploring the members of the Regency Council to intervene in his behalf. There was no response, and he swallowed convulsively as his eyes came back to Charlian. She waited another measured 30 seconds, but none of the convicted men spoke again, and she nodded. It was time to end this, and she could at least give them the mercy of swiftness. "It is our judgment that, for the crimes of which you stand convicted, you be taken from this place immediately to a place of execution, and there beheaded. You will be granted access to clergy of your choice, but sentence will be carried out within this very hour, and may God have mercy on your souls." 8. City Engineer's Office and Royal Palace, Princedom of Coruscant. "That was a good job you did on the guild hall, Berend," Sylvain Grassman said as Berend Lebran, who didn't look a thing like Patrick Henry, stepped into his office. "That cistern's been nothing but a pain in the ass for as long as I can remember." "It wasn't hard once I realized the pump casing had to be leaking," Henry replied. He shrugged. "Actually, finding the leak and getting to it was a bitch. But fixing it, once I found it, was pretty routine, really. Well, I've been sending people over to look at it for the better part of a half a year now," Grassman grumbled. "And you're the first one to find the problem. I know you're still new, Barend, but if the master engineer will go along with me, you're going to be a supervisor by this time next month." "I appreciate the vote of confidence," Henry said, although he was fairly certain the promotion wouldn't come through. "I just try to do my job." He gazed out of Grassman's office window. Dusk was coming on quickly, and he and the supervisor should already have left for the evening. In fact, they would have if Henry hadn't gone to some lengths to arrange otherwise. He had known Grassman would want a detailed report on how he'd solved the problem, and he'd manipulated his own schedule to ensure he'd be late getting back to the large, rambling block of buildings on Horsewalk Square, which housed the city engineer's offices. Grassman had waited for him in order to get his report firsthand, and the supervisor had listened carefully as Henry ran through everything he'd had to do to fix it. The truth was that he'd enjoyed the challenge, and it had been the biggest job he'd been assigned since he'd started working his way up in the city's engineering and maintenance services. He'd begun as little more than a common labourer, a necessity, if he wanted to be certain no one asked any questions about his previous employers. It wasn't as if the work were exceptionally difficult, however, especially for a man who'd run his own business for so many years. And the Guildhall plumbing system's mysterious water losses had at least offered a puzzle sufficient to distract him from the future rushing rapidly towards him. As he'd told Grassman, figuring out what had to be wrong hadn't been hard. The city reservoir, just northwest of Manchir's walls, was fed by the Barkhor River before the river flowed on through the city itself, becoming distinctively less potable in the process, and not just from storm runoff. And feed pipes from the reservoir flowed under the city itself. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough head pressure in the system to move water higher than the first floor of most of the city's buildings, which was one reason for the picturesque windmills spinning busily away on the rooftops of so many of the taller buildings all across the capital. They powered pumps, which lifted water from the low-pressure mains to rooftop or water tower cisterns high enough for gravity-feed systems to develop reasonable pressure throughout the city. The problem at the Weavers' Guildhall was that the cistern level had been far below design specifications and still dropping. Obviously, there was a problem somewhere between the main and the cistern, but the pump itself had been operating perfectly. It was an ancient design with an endless chain of flat, pivoted links travelling in a loop through a pair of shafts. Lifters, bronze saucers closely fitted to the diameter of the shafts, were set every foot or so along the chain, which travelled between the water main and the cistern. Water flowed into the inlet chamber at the bottom, which was slightly larger in diameter than the lifters. The lifters, however, formed a sort of moving cylinder inside the outflow shaft, capturing and lifting water as they moved through the inlet chamber and upward. With a good head of wind, a large enough windmill, and a wide enough pump shaft, the system could move hundreds of gallons of water very quickly. Floats in the cisterns raised interrupter rods to disengage the windmill's steadying vanes when the holding tanks were full, letting the windmills pivot off the wind and go idle to prevent the pumps from raising too much water and simply wasting it. And most of the cisterns were large enough to meet demand in their buildings for at least a couple of windless days in a row. It was a simple, reliable arrangement, whose greatest vulnerability was the possibility that the chain might break. The gearing needed a change of lubricating oil about once a year, but aside from that, the only other real maintenance concern was the durability of the flexible gaskets fitted to the edge of each lifter to ensure a good seal with the sides of the lift shaft. The gaskets were made from the sap of the rubber plant with which the Archangel Sondheim had gifted mankind at the creation, and whose cultivation was a major income source for Coruscant, and wore out only slowly, but eventually they did have to be replaced. The Guildhall pump had shown no signs of excessive wear, however, even though it was delivering progressively less water despite running almost constantly. So the answer had to be that the water was escaping somewhere between the inlet and the cistern. But where? A diligent search had revealed no obvious leaks, but Henry had known there had to be one, so he'd persevered until he finally found it. What had made it so difficult was that it was quite high, yet there'd been no signs of leakage, because the break in the shaft wall had occurred where it passed through a stone wall directly adjacent to the roof drainage system. Given the intensity of the rainstorms which frequently smote Manchir, the Guildhall's downspouts and gutters were designed to handle a lot of water. And at the point where the break had appeared, one of the main drain channels had been separated from the shaft only by a single, relatively thin layer of cement. Once the shaft started leaking through the dividing cement, it had simply discharged itself down the drain, where no one ever saw it, and there was no telltale seepage on any walls or gathering in the cellars. It had also happened to be one of only two sections of the shaft which couldn't be eyeballed in a routine inspection, which ought to have suggested something to someone, since routine inspections had so singularly failed to find the problem. Henry had been forced to lower himself down the outer edge of the building, pry loose two large building blocks, and then chip his way through the drainage channel's inch-thick wall before he could confirm his suspicions. Actually, getting to the problem and fixing it had been relatively straightforward after that, although that didn't mean it hadn't still required plenty of hard work and sweat. In fact, he damned well deserved Grassman's praise. "Well, I just wish more of our people tried as hard to do their jobs as you do," the supervisor said now. "We'd be in a lot better shape, let me tell you. Not that we're having much luck getting the budget we need out of the Regency Council." He shook his head disgustedly. "We need someone on the council who understands engineering problems, the kind that keeps cities like Manchir running and not just the ones that go into making newfangled weapons." Henry nodded vigorously. It was one of Grassman's recurrent refrains, and the supervisor probably had a point, although Henry's own problems with the Regency Council focused on rather different concerns. However, "I meant to ask you for your impression of this Empress Charlian," he said, forcing himself to speak the hated name in an almost normal tone. "I think she's impressive." Grassman leaned back in his chair, scratching the back of his neck, and shook his head slowly. "Somebody said she was beautiful, but me, I'm not so sure. She's a handsome woman, I'll give her that, but beautiful?" He shook his head again. "Too much nose, and those eyes of hers. Trust me, Baron, she's got a temper that would make a slash lizard run for cover." "So was she ranting and raving?" Henry asked. "No, no, she wasn't." Grassman stopped scratching the back of his neck and looked up at Henry, his eyes unfocused with memory. "In fact, that's the reason she's so impressive, if you ask me. It's not natural for a young woman that age, and one who's hated the House of Dakin so long, to not lose her temper at a time like this. I mean, here she's in a perfect position to hammer us after what those idiots tried to pull, and she's cool as a cucumber. Not wishy-washy, don't misunderstand me. I think she was madder than Shanway's hell at Craggy Hill, at least. But she didn't scream, she didn't shout, and she just ordered them beheaded. Didn't have them tortured, didn't send their family members after them on general principle, didn't even have them hanged. Just a short, sharp appointment with an axe, and it was all over." He shook his head again. "I'll be honest with you, Barind. I can't see the old prince letting them off that easy. I'd say she's got a short way with people who cross her, but she's not going out of her way to be any nastier about it than she has to." "You sound as if you actually admire her." Henry couldn't quite keep the disapproval out of his voice, and Grassman's eyes refocused as the supervisor looked up at him. "Didn't say that," he said a bit testily. "Mind you, I'm of the opinion we could do worse, if only her damned husband hadn't had Prince Hector murdered. For that matter, if young Davin were to come home, and assuming the Regency Council could keep his head on his shoulders when he did, I don't think she'd go out of her way to be nasty to him, either. Not so long as he didn't cross her leastways." "Maybe," Henry shrugged. "And I'm no noble, or a member of Parliament, either. All the same, Master Grassman, it seems to me that sooner or later there'd come a time when Prince Davin would have to cross her, if he was going to be true to Coruscant. And from what you're saying..." He let his voice trail off, and Grassman nodded unhappily. "I'm inclined to think you've got a point," he sighed. "Hopefully, though, it's not anything that's going to happen soon. And if I were young Davin, I'd be staying far, far away from Coruscant until Mother Church gets done sorting out what's going to happen with this Empire of Kairos and Church of Kairos." It was Henry's turn to nod. Although he'd come to suspect Grassman was at least mildly reformist at heart himself. Perhaps that was why he wasn't as outraged as Henry at Charlian Armagh's presence here in Manchir. "You're probably right," he said. "Are you looking forward to tomorrow?" "Not really." Grassman's expression was troubled. "I mean, I know it's an honour and everything, but I don't really like watching men being sentenced to death. Langhorne knows they spent long enough on the trials. If they weren't doing their best to be sure everything was done right and proper, they sure used up a lot of time doing something else. And I didn't hear any of them yesterday claiming they hadn't been given a fair trial. Except maybe that sorry piece of shit, Barco. But I still don't like watching. Funny thing is, I don't think she likes being there any better than I do. He gave a brief laugh. I guess she's got even less choice about it than I do, though. Henry nodded again, though he doubted Empress Charlian was as bothered by all of this as Grassman seemed to think. The supervisor really didn't have a choice, though. He was one of the randomly selected city professionals who'd been chosen to witness what happened, and attendance wasn't optional. Charlian and the Regency Council seemed determined to make certain there were plenty of eyes to see and tongues to tell what happened to whoever dared to raise his hand against their tyranny and treason. "Well, Master Grassman," he said now, "it may be you won't have to be there tomorrow after all. Things can change, you know." "I wish it would," Grassman said feelingly, pushing his chair back and starting around the end of his desk. "I've got enough other things I could be doing, and like I say, I don't like watch—" His eyes widened in stunned horror as Henry's right hand came up from his side and the short, keen-edged dagger drove home at the base of his throat. His voice died in a horrible gurgle and his hands reached up, clutching at Henry's wrist. But the strength was flowing out of him with the flood of his blood, and Henry twisted the blade as he drew it sideways. The flood became a torrent, and he stepped back as Grassman thudded to the office floor with his eyes already glazing. "I'm sorry," Henry said. He knelt beside the body for a moment and signed Langhorne's scepter on the supervisor's forehead. "You weren't a perfect man, but you deserved better than this. I'm about God's work, though, so perhaps he'll forgive both of us." He patted Grassman on the shoulder, then started going through the dead man's pockets. He needed only a handful of minutes to find what he sought, and he stood once more. He gazed down at the body again briefly as he slipped the ornately engraved summons into his pocket, then turned and stepped out of the office and used the key he had also taken from Grassman to lock the office door before he started down the stairs. He went the back way, reasonably confident he wouldn't be running into anyone this late. He'd managed to avoid most of the blood spray anyway, and once he got out into the settling gloom, the few drops he hadn't been able to avoid shouldn't be very noticeable. If he was spotted before he got clear, or if someone should enter Grassman's office despite the locked door between now and morning, that would be the end of his plan. But he knew in his heart of hearts it wouldn't happen. As he had told Grassman, he was about God's work, and, unlike mortal men, God did not suffer his work to go undone. Charlian Armagh sat once again on the dais in Princess Alethea's ballroom. They'd gotten an earlier start today, and even less sunlight came in through the ballroom's windows, so lamps had been lit in niches around the walls. Despite their brightly polished reflectors, they didn't shed a great deal of light, so stands of candles had been placed at either end of the document table for Spinesir Arnald and Father Nathan's use. Once the sun finally cleared the roof of the palace, wings shading the windows, things should get better, she told herself, then nodded to Arnald to strike the gong. "Draw nigh and give ear," the same chamberlain called as the musical note vibrated its way back into silence. "Give ear to the crown's justice." The double doors opened once more, and four men, or perhaps three men and a boy, since one of them was clearly not yet out of his teens, were ushered through it. One of the older men wore the subdued finery of a minor noble, or at least a man of substantial wealth. The second looked as if he was probably a reasonably well-off city merchant, And the third, the oldest of the group with iron-grey hair and a spade beard, was clearly an artisan of some sort, possibly a blacksmith, from his weathered complexion and powerfully muscled arms. The youngest was very plainly clothed, but someone, his mother perhaps, had seen to it that, plain though his garments might be, they were scrupulously clean and neat. She studied their expressions as the guards ushered them, firmly, but without brutality, to their place in front of the dais. Despite the dimness of the light, she could see them quite clearly, thanks to the multifunction contact lenses Merlin and Owl had provided her, and she recognized the apprehension in their faces only too plainly. "I don't blame them for that in the least," she thought grimly. "And I hadn't realized how badly yesterday was going to depress me, either. I know it had to be done, and I knew it was going to be bad, but even so." Her own expression was serene and calm with years of discipline and training, but behind that mask she saw again the previous day's unending procession of convicted traitors. Craggy Hill and his companions had received the honour of appearing before her first, but 27 more men and 6 women had followed them. Followed them not simply before Charlian's dais, but to the executioner. 39 human beings in a single day. The first day, she thought, trying not to dwell on how many days of this were yet to go. Not many compared to the number that get killed on even a small battlefield, I suppose. And unlike the people who get killed in battles, every single one of them had earned conviction and execution. But I'm the one who pronounced their sentences. I may not have swung the axe, but I certainly wielded the sword. Her own thoughts before her arrival in Zebediah came back to her, and the knowledge that she'd been right then was cold comfort now. "But at least I don't have to send them all to death," she reminded herself, squaring her shoulders as the quartet of prisoners halted before her. Spineseer Arnald stood and opened another of those deadly folders, then turned to Charlian.
"Your Majesty," he said, "we bring before you, accused of treason, Zulus Palman, Parseval Lambert, Astel Ibbot, and Charles Dobbins. I attest that all of them were tried before a court of church, lords and commons, and that all rites and procedures were carefully observed," Father Nathan added. "Each had benefit of counsel and was allowed to examine all the evidence against him, and each was permitted to summon witnesses of his choice to testify on his behalf." It was obvious the Langhornite was repeating a well-rehearsed formula, Charlian thought. Yet it wasn't a routine formula. He and his 2 assistants actually had examined each of the court dockets and case records individually. Upon what grounds were they accused?
"Upon the following specifications, Your Majesty," Arnald said, consulting yet another folder. "Master Palman stands accused of extending letters of credit upon his banking house, and of contributing his personal funds to the raising, equipping, and training of armsmen in the service of Duke Craggy Hill's conspiracy. He also had personal knowledge of the Duke's plans to assassinate Duke Anvil Rock and Duke Tartarian as the first step of their coup. Master Lambert stands accused of allowing ships and freight wagons owned and employed by him to transport pikes, swords, muskets, and gunpowder for the purpose of arming the forces with which Duke Craggy Hill's conspiracy intended to seize control of the city of Leon in the earldom of Tartarian. Master Ibbot stands accused of joining the armed band intended to seize control of Leon. He is also accused of lending his smithy as a place in which to conceal weapons, and of assuming the acting rank of captain in the band being raised in that place. And Master Dobbins stands accused of helping to plan, organize, and train the individuals who,
in accordance with Bishop Executor Tommy Shiler's instructions, were to attack the garrison from within in a spontaneous uprising here in Manchir should Craggy Hill's forces approach the city. Charlian sat for a moment, looking at all four of them. Ibit and Palman looked back at her with hopeless but unyielding defiance. Lambert seemed sunk in resignation, his eyes fixed on the floor, his shoulders sagging. Dobbins, the youngest of the three by a good 15 years or more, looked frankly terrified. He was fighting to conceal it, that much was obvious, but she could see it in the taut shoulders, the hands clenched into fists at his sides, the lips tightly compressed to keep them from trembling. "And has the court, which heard their cases, reached a verdict?" she asked.
"It has, Your Majesty," Arnald replied. "All of them have been adjudged guilty of all charges brought against them."
He extracted a thin sheaf of documents from his folder.
"The verdicts have been signed, sealed, and mutually witnessed by every member of the court, Your Majesty."
"Thank you," Charlian said, and silence echoed as she swept her brown eyes once again across all four of those faces. "One of a monarch's duties is to punish criminal actions," she said finally. "It's a grim duty, and one not lightly to be embraced. It leaves its weight here." She touched her own chest. "Yet it may not be shirked, either. It must be dealt with by any ruler worthy of the crown he or she wears. The courts here in your own princedom have weighed the evidence against you and found all of you guilty of the crimes charged against you. And, as all of you are painfully aware by this time, the sentence for your crimes is death. There is no lesser sentence we may impose upon you, and so we sentence you to die." Lambert's shoulders twitched, and young Dobbins closed his eyes, swaying slightly. But Ibit and Palman only looked back at her. Clearly the sentence had come as no surprise to any of them. "Yet, having passed that sentence," Charlian said after a moment, "we wish to make a brief digression." Lambert's gaze rose from the floor, his expression confused, and Dobbin's eyes popped open in surprise. The other two looked less confused than Lambert, but the wariness in their expressions only intensified. "Father Nathan has reviewed every case, every verdict to be brought before us for the sad duty of rendering sentence. Yet we have reviewed these cases, these verdicts as well, and not simply with the eye of a law master whose duty it is to see that all the stern requirements of the law he serves have been faithfully observed. And because we've reviewed those cases, we know, Master Ibit, that you joined the rebellion against the Regency Council not simply because of your religious beliefs, which are deeply and sincerely held, but because your brother and your nephew died in the Battle of Darkos Sand. Your eldest son died in Talbot Pass, and your youngest son died in the Battle of Green Valley." Ibit's strong, weathered face seemed to crumple. Then it solidified into stone, yet Charlian's aided vision saw a tear glimmer in the dim light as she reminded him of all he'd lost. "As for you, Master Palman," she continued, turning to the banker, "we know you asked nothing from Craggy Hill or the other conspirators when you provided them with the money they sought from you. We know you ruined yourself providing those funds, and we know you did it because you were a devout temple loyalist. But we also know you did it because your son, André, was a member of Prince Hector's personal guard, who gave his life saving his prince from an assassin's arbalest bolt, and that you believe that assassin was sent by Karis. He wasn't." She looked directly into Palman's eyes. "We give you our word. I give you my word as Charlian Armak, not as an empress, that that assassin was not sent by Karis, yet that doesn't change the fact that you believed he was."
And you, Master Lambert. The greengrocer's gaze snapped to her face. You aided the conspirators because they needed your wagons and your barges, and they took steps to see they had them. Your sister and her family, and your parents, live in Talitha, do they not? Lambert's eyes flared wide. And Duke Stormkeep's agents told you what would happen to them if you chose not to cooperate. Lambert nodded convulsively, almost as if it were against his will, and she tilted her head to one side. That was what you told the court, yet there wasn't a single witness to confirm it, was there? Not even your sister, as much as she longed to. For that matter, we very much doubt Duke Stormkeep, for all the crimes of which he was most assuredly guilty, would truly have murdered an elderly couple, their daughter, their son-in-law, and their grandchildren, simply because you refused to cooperate. Yet we believe the threat was made, and there was no way you might have known it hadn't been made in all sincerity. She looked into Lambert's face, seeing the shock, the disbelief, that anyone, especially she, might actually have believed his story. She held his gaze for several seconds in the dim light, and then turned to Dobbins. And you, Master Dobbins. The young man twitched as if she'd just touched him with a hot iron, and despite the gravity and grimness of the moment, she felt her lips try to smile. She crushed the temptation and looked sternly down at him from her throne. You lost no one in battle against Caris, Master Dobbins, she told him. You lost no one to an assassin's bolts, and no one threatened your family. For that matter, we rather doubt your religious convictions run so deep and so fiercely as to have compelled you to join this conspiracy. Yet it's obvious to us that the true reason for your complicity, the true flaw which brings you to this place this day, is far simpler than any of those. Stupidity. Dobbins jerked again, his expression incredulous, and for a moment the entire ballroom seemed frozen in place. Then someone cracked a laugh, and others joined him, unable not to be the moment ever so grim. Charlian smiled herself briefly, but then she banished the expression and leaned forward slightly. Do not mistake us, Master Dobbins, she said coldly through the last ripples of amusement. This is no laughing matter. People would have died had you succeeded in the task the Bishop Executor had assigned you, and you knew it. But we believe you had also strayed into dark and dangerous waters before you truly understood what you were doing. We believe that thoroughly. Though your actions merit the sentence we've passed upon you, your death will accomplish nothing, heal nothing, have no effect but to deprive you of any opportunity to learn from your mistakes. She sat back in the throne, looking down at all four of them, then looked beyond them to the watching spectators. It's a monarch's duty to judge the guilty, to sentence the convicted, and to see to it that punishment is carried out, she said clearly. But it's also a monarch's duty to temper punishment with compassion, and to recognize when the public good may be served as well by mercy as by severity. In our judgment, all of you, even you, Master Dobbins, did what you did in the sincere belief that God wanted you to. It's also our belief that none of you acted out of ambition or calculation or a desire for power. Your actions were crimes, but you committed them out of patriotism, belief, grief, and what you genuinely believed duty required. We can't excuse the crimes you committed, but we can, and we do, understand why you committed them. She paused once more, and then she smiled again. It was a thin smile, but a genuine one. We would like for you and everyone to believe that we understand because of our own saintliness. Unfortunately,
While we may be many things, a saint is not one of them. We try as best we may to live as we believe God would have us live. Yet we must also balance that desire against our responsibilities and the practical considerations of a crown. Sometimes, however, it becomes possible for those responsibilities and practical considerations to march with the things we believe God would have us do, and this is one of those moments. She watched hope blossom on four faces, newborn and fragile, not yet able or willing to believe in itself. We must punish those responsible for evil, and we must show to all the world that we will punish our enemies, she said softly. Yet we must also prove, I must prove, that we are not the mindless slaves to vengeance who currently hold Mother Church in their grasp. Where we may exercise mercy, we will. Not because we are such a wonderful and saintly person, but because it is the right thing to do, and because we realize that while we may destroy our foes with punishment, we can win friends and hearts only with mercy. It's our belief that all four of you would make better friends and subjects than enemies, and we wish to find out if our belief is accurate. And so we commute your sentences. We grant you pardon for all those crimes of which you were convicted, and bid all four of you go, return to your lives. Understand us, should any of you ever stand before us again, convicted of new crimes, there will be no mercy the second time. Her brown eyes hardened briefly, but then the hardness passed. Yet we do not think we will see you here again, and we will pray that the hurt and the fear and the anger which drove you to your actions will ease with the passage of time and God's love. Grassman had been wrong, Patrick Henry decided. Empress Charlian was a beautiful woman, and not simply because of the magnificence of her clothing or the crown of state glittering on her head under the lamplight. Hate churned in his belly whenever he looked at her, yet he couldn't deny the simple truth. And physical beauty, when it came down to it, was one of Shanwei's most deadly weapons. It was easy for a young and beautiful queen to inspire loyalty and devotion, where some twisted crone whose physical envelope was as ugly as her soul would have found it far more difficult. She had a commanding presence, too. Despite her youthfulness, she was clearly the dominant figure in the huge ballroom, and not simply because every witness knew she was there to send those brought before her to the headsman. Henry had learned more than a few of the orators and politicians' tricks, building his resistance movement here in Manchia, and he recognized someone who'd mastered those skills far more completely than he had, especially now. Total silence had fallen as she told the foursome in front of her to simply go home. No one had expected it, and her knowledge of each of the four convicted men had startled everyone. She'd consulted no notes, needed no memorandums. She had known what each of them had done, and even more, she'd known why he had done it. Coruscandians were unaccustomed to monarchs or nobles or clerics who looked that deeply into the lives of those brought before them for judgment. And then she had pardoned them. Their guilt had been proven, the sentence had been passed, and she had exercised an empress prerogative and pardoned them. Even Henry, who recognized a cynical political maneuver when he saw one, sat stunned by the totally unanticipated turn of events. But the silence didn't linger. He didn't know who started it, but the single pair of clapping hands somewhere among the benches of witnesses was joined in a rippling, swelling torrent by more, then more. Within seconds, Princess Alethea's ballroom was filled with the thunder of applause, and Patrick Henry made himself come to his own feet, sharing that applause even as he cringed inside when someone so deceived by Charlian's ploy actually shouted, "God save your majesty!" It took the guardsmen stationed throughout the ballroom several minutes to even begin restoring order, and Henry took advantage of the confusion to change his position. Still clapping, obviously lost in his enthusiasm for Empress Charlian's compassion and mercy, he stepped forward, shouldering his way through other applauding witnesses. He'd been seated 3 benches back. By the time the applause began to die away, he'd reached the front row. The thunder of clapping hands faded, not instantly and quickly, but into smaller clusters that gradually slowed and then ceased, and Patrick Henry's right hand slid into the formal tunic which had cost him every one of the hard-earned marks he had managed to save up over the past 6 months. It was probably better than any the real Grassman had owned, but it had been worth every mark he had paid. Coupled with Grassman's summons to attend, his respectable garb had gotten him waved past the sentries stationed outside the ballroom. The sergeant who had checked his summons had actually nodded respectfully to him, unaware of the way Henry's heart had hammered and his palms had sweated. Yet there was no sweat on those palms now, and he felt a great swelling surge of elation, of accomplishment. God had brought him to this time and this place for a reason, and Patrick Henry would not fail him. Merlin Athroyes stood at Charlian's back, watching the crowd. Owl had deployed sensor remotes at strategic points as well, but even with the AI's assistance, there were too many people for Merlin to feel comfortable. There were simply too many bodies packed into the ballroom. "I wish Edward and I had argued harder against this entire idea," he thought as the clapping and cheers began to die away. "Oh, it's a masterstroke, no question. But this is a damned nightmare from a security perspective. Still, it looks like..." "Death to all heretics!" Henry shouted, and his hand came out of his tunic. Merlin might no longer be human, but he felt his heart freeze as the shrill shout cut through the fading cheers. Even a creature of Molyseuch's, with a reaction speed far greater than any flesh and blood human, could be paralyzed, however briefly, by shock. For the tiniest sliver of an instant, he could only stand there, his head snapping around, eyes searching for the person who'd shouted. He saw the bearded man standing in the front row, well-dressed, but obviously not an aristocrat. Then he saw the man's right hand, and his own hand flashed towards the pistol at his side, even as he leapt forward and his other hand reached for Charlian. But that instant of shock had held him just too long. The double-barreled pistol in Henry's hand had been made in Caris. He had found that grimly appropriate when one of his original followers ambushed and murdered a marine officer and brought him the weapon as a trophy. It had been surprisingly difficult to acquire any sort of accuracy with the thing, and he'd quickly used up all of the ammunition which had been captured with it. A silversmith had no problem preparing the mold he needed to cast his own bullets, however, and he'd practiced hard, even before Sir Corin Garvey had arrested Father Adrian and broken Henry's own organization. He'd also sawed 2 inches off its barrel in order to make it more easily concealable, and he'd devised a canvas scabbard to carry it under his left arm, hidden inside his generously cut tunic. There'd been times he'd wondered why he'd bothered, and why he'd kept a weapon which would automatically have convicted him of treason against the Regency Council if it had been found in his possession. Now, as the heel of his left hand cocked both locks in a single practiced swipe, his right hand raised the weapon, and he squeezed the trigger. Flame flashed from the pistol's priming pan, and Merlin heard the distinctive chuff-crack of a discharging flintlock in the instant before he reached Charlian. His own pistol fired in the same fragment of time. It all happened far too quickly, too chaotically, for even a pika to sort out. The two shots sounded as one. The assassin's second barrel discharged into the floor. Merlin's fingertips touched Charlian's shoulder, and he heard her sudden sharp grunt of anguish. Impossible. The single word had time to flash through Patrick Henry's mind before the sapphire-eyed guardsman's bullet exploded through his right lung, a quarter inch from his heart. No human being could move that quickly, react that quickly. Then the agony ripped him apart. He heard himself cry out, felt the pistol buck in his hand as the second barrel fired uselessly, felt himself going to his knees. He dropped the smoking weapon, both hands clawed at the brutal chest wound. He felt blood spraying from his mouth and nostrils in a choking, coppery tide, and a sudden, terrible fear roared through him. It wasn't supposed to be like this. He'd come here knowing he was going to his death, succeed or fail. So what was wrong with him? Why should the actual approach of death terrify him this way? What had happened to his faith, his belief? And where was God's comfort and courage when he needed him most? There were no answers, only the questions, and he felt even them pouring out of him with his blood as he swayed and then toppled weakly from his knees. "But I did it," he told himself, his cheek pressed into the floor in the hot pool of his own blood as the blackness came for him. "I did it. I killed the bitch." And somehow, in that last bitter moment of awareness, it meant nothing at all. 9. Sir Corin Garvey's townhouse and Royal Palace, City of Manchu.
"So what do you think of her now, Alec?"
Corin Garvey sat back in his comfortable chair, listening to rain drum on the roof. The lanterns illuminating the garden at the heart of the square-built townhouse were barely visible through the pounding raindrops, and thunder rumbled intermittently, still somewhere to the south, but rolling steadily closer.
"I'd ask her to marry me if she weren't already married to an emperor,"
Alec Arthur said. He reached out to the punch bowl on the table and steadied gently with the silver ladle, then snorted.
"And if she didn't scare me to death," he added.
"Now, why should she do a thing like that?"
Garvey's father asked sardonically. He sat at the head of the table, in the chair which would normally have been his son's, nursing a glass of Chisholmian whiskey.
"It's not like she's done anything extraordinary lately now, is it?"
All five of the men sitting around that table looked at one another as a louder peal of thunder grumbled its way across the heavens. Lightning flickered, and Garvey raised his own glass in an acknowledging salute to his father before he looked at the Duke of Tartarian and Sir Charles Doyle.
"Did either of you see that coming?" he asked. "Which that did you have in mind?"
Tartarian inquired dryly.
"Her performance? The assassination attempt? Sajin Merlin, or the fact that she survived?"
"How about all of the above?" Garvey retorted.
"I didn't see any of it coming at any rate," Doyle admitted. "Just for starters, she certainly hadn't discussed any pardons that I knew of."
He raised his eyebrows at Duke Anvil Rock and Duke Tartarian, but both of the older men shook their heads.
"Not with us," Anvil Rock said. "And I had a word with Archbishop Claremont afterward, too. She hadn't mentioned anything about it to him either."
"I didn't think she had," Doyle said.
"And something I find almost as interesting is that she didn't ask anyone for a copy of their trial transcripts either, despite which she seemed to know more about all of them than we did."
"That might actually be the most easily explained part of it," Tartarian observed.
Doyle looked at him with an expression of polite incredulity, and the Earl chuckled.
"Don't forget, it was Sajin Merlin's agents here in Coruscant that put us onto the plot in the first place,
and we still don't have any idea how they gathered some of the information they gave us." He shrugged. "All we do know is that every bit of that information checked out when we investigated. I think it's entirely possible they may have kept back some facts and suspicions they figured couldn't be proven in a court, and I don't imagine Merlin would have many reservations about sharing something like that with Empress Shalien."
"I suppose that could explain it,"
Doyle said in a tone which implied he believed nothing of the sort, and Tartarian pointed an index finger at him.
"Don't you go shooting holes in my perfectly good theory unless you've got one to replace it with, young man," he said severely.
Doyle, who wasn't that many years Tartarian's junior, laughed, and Tartarian shook his head. But then his expression sobered.
"And don't go shooting holes in my theory until you've got an explanation that won't scare the shit out of me when you come up with it either."
"She really is more than a little frightening, isn't she?" Garvey said into the small silence Tartarian's last sentence had produced. Lightning flashed again overhead, close enough this time that the thunderclap seemed to rattle the opened garden windows in their frames.
"I'm not sure frightening is exactly the right word," his father objected, but Tartarian made a moderately rude noise in his throat. "It'll do until we can come up with a better one, Rytle," he said.
"I think a lot of it was Archbishop Michael's fault," Doyle put in.
The others looked at him, and he raised his right hand, palm uppermost, as if he were releasing an invisible bird.
"Remember how he reacted after that assassination attempt in Telisberg Cathedral? According to the reports, he didn't even hesitate, just went ahead and celebrated Mass with the assassin's blood and brain splashed all over his vestments. Frankly, I had my doubts about the stories at the time. Now I'm starting to think it must be something in the water in Caris."
"You may be righter about that than you think you are, Charles,"
Garvey said ruefully.
Doyle raised an eyebrow, and Garvey shrugged.
"Don't forget, before he celebrated Mass, he also rebuked the members of his congregation who wanted to go out and start stringing up temple loyalists in revenge. Does that remind you of anything?"
Doyle gazed at him for a moment, then nodded, and Garvey nodded back, while his mind replayed the chaos and confusion of the assassination attempt. The only thing he'd been able to think when the would-be killer shouted was that Caleb Armack would never forgive Coruscant for allowing his wife to be murdered on her very throne. There'd be no way the man could miss, not from a range of no more than 15 feet. Garvey would have been one of the first to admit that it was far harder to fire a pistol accurately than most people probably believed, especially when someone was gripped by the excitement and terror of a moment like that. Still, at that range, the man could almost have reached out and touched her with the pistol's muzzle before he pulled the trigger. But his fears, like the assassin, apparently, had failed to reckon with Merlin Athroy's. Despite all the stories Garvey had heard, and despite the things he knew firsthand were true, he would never have believed any mortal man could move that quickly. The Sagin clearly hadn't seen anything coming before the assassin produced his weapon. Despite that, the first two shots had sounded as one, and his bullet had hit the man who'd been identified as Barind Lebran. Although Garvey sincerely doubted that had been his true name, before Lebran could fire his second shot, the smear of lead where Lebran's second bullet smashed into the marble floor was barely 2 feet in front of where his body had fallen, and Spineser Arnald's left shoulder had been grazed by the ricochet before it buried itself in the ceiling. Garvey had been in more than his fair share of chaotic, violent situations. He knew how impressions could blur, how a man could be absolutely positive of what he'd seen, and yet absolutely wrong about what had actually happened. and Merlin had reacted so quickly, moved with such speed once he did see the weapon, that he had seemed almost to have been teleported by a wizard's spell out of some children's tale. But still, granting all of that, it simply didn't seem possible Charlianne could have been missed. Yet when Captain Athroyes rolled aside, coming up on one knee from where he'd covered her protectively with his own body, she'd been unhurt. Well, perhaps not totally unhurt, which certainly shouldn't surprise anyone. Merlin had been more concerned with protecting her from assassins than gentleness, and the weight of an armored man his size coming down that hard would have been enough to knock the breath out of anyone. From Charlianne's expression and the tightness of her shoulders when Merlin assisted her to her feet, Garve had been certain for one heart-stopping moment that she had been hit. She had leaned to her left hand pressed hard against her ribs, and her face had been pale and strained. But then she had straightened, drawn an obviously cautious breath, and shaken her head, hard, at something Merlin must have said into her ear. Shouts and screams had still filled the huge chamber, and no one else had been close enough to hear what the Sajin might have said anyway, but Garve had no doubt at all what Merlin had advised. Unfortunately, even Sajins had their limits, and one of those limits, clearly, was Charlianne Tate Armagh. "Be seated," she had shouted, and somehow she had managed to pitch her voice so that it could be heard. Not by very many people at first, but those closest to her first stared at her in disbelief, and then started repeating her command at the top of their lungs. In less than 2 minutes, by some sorcery Garve couldn't come close to understanding, she had actually managed to restore something like order, as she stood almost straight, one hand still pressed to her side. Merlin Athroyes had stood beside her, his pistol still in his right hand, merciless sapphire eyes scanning the witness-filled benches, and Sergeant Seahamper had stood on her other side, with an expression which could only be described as murderous. Garve hadn't blamed either of them at all. God only knew if there was another assassin out there. It didn't seem possible, but then Garve wouldn't have believed the first one could have gotten in unchallenged. And if there was another assassin, the slender white and blue-clad figure who had lost her crown and whose long hair had come tumbling down about her shoulders would be a perfect target. She had seemed unaware of that, however, just as she had seemed unaware of the bruise already darkening her left cheek. She had simply stood there, exposed to any follow-up shot, willing the Coruscandians back onto their benches. Only after the last of them sat had she seated herself once more, sitting very erect, her left elbow beside her, and her upper arm still pressed against those ribs. "Thank you," she had said in a calm voice, whose normality seemed utterly bizarre under the circumstances. Then she had actually managed a smile, and if it was a bit shaky and passed quickly, who should blame her? She had reached up with her right hand, tucking a strand of that fallen, glorious sable hair behind her ear, and shaken her head. "I deeply regret that this should have happened," she had said, looking down at the body in the pool of blood as four of Garve's guardsmen prepared to remove it. Her eloquent brown eyes had been shadowed, and she had shaken her head sadly. "Surely God weeps to see such violence loosed among his children." Stillness had seemed to flow outward from her. The scraping sound of the corpse's heels as the guardsmen picked up the body had seemed shockingly loud in the silence. And the Empress had turned her head, watching as the man who'd tried to kill her was carried from her presence. A trail of blood droplets had followed him, dark in the lamplight as the guardsmen and their burden vanished through the double doors, and she had gazed at those doors for a handful of heartbeats before she had turned once more to look out at the assembled witnesses. There are times, she had told them quietly, almost softly, when all the killing and all the hatred strike me to the heart, when I wonder what sort of world my daughter will inherit, what kind of men and women will decide how the people of that world live, what they're allowed to believe. Garvey's eyes had widened as he realized she'd abandoned the royal we, and they'd gone even wider as he saw those benches filled with Coruscandians leaning towards a Chisholmian queen who was also a Carisian empress and listening intently. She had no longer been a conquering monarch dispensing justice and retribution. She'd been something else. A young mother worried about her own child. A young woman who'd just survived a murder attempt. And a voice of calm when she should have been demanding vengeance upon those who had allowed such a thing to happen. "Is this what we truly wish?" she had asked in that same quiet voice. "To settle our differences with murder? For those of us on one side to leave those on the other no option but to kill or to be killed? It grieves my soul to know how many people, some of them known personally to me, some of them beloved friends and kinsmen, and far more who I never met but who were someone's kinsmen or kinswomen or beloved, have already died. Yet the death toll is only starting. Yesterday I sat here in front of you and sent 39 people to the headsman. Tomorrow and the next day I'll send still more, because I have no choice. And those decisions, those confirmations of the sentences of those brought before me, will live with me for the rest of my own life. Do you think any sane woman wants to order the deaths of others? Do you truly believe I wouldn't rather, far rather, pardon, as I've just pardoned Master Ibbet, Master Palman, Master Lambert and young Dobbins? Despite anything the group of four may say, God does not call us to exult in the blood and agony of our enemies." She had paused, her expression sad, her eyes dark in the shadows yet lit by the lamplight, while the stink of blood and voided bowels and the brimstone reek of gun smoke drifted like Shan Wei's perfume. And then she had shaken her head. "I wish I had some magic wand that could make all this go away. But I don't, and I can't. The only peace someone like Zaspar Clintan will ever accept is the destruction of everything I know and love and hold dear. The only agreement he will ever tolerate is one in which his own twisted, vicious perversion of God's will rules each and every one of God's children. Caris didn't start this war, my friends. Caris simply survived the war someone else launched at her like a slash lizard crazed by blood. And Caris will continue to do what she must, to go on surviving, because that's what she owes to her own people, to her own children, and to God himself. Which is what brings me to this throne in this room, delivering and confirming sentences of death. Many of these people amply deserve those sentences. For others the case is less clear-cut, however clear the law itself may be. And in still other cases, what the law decrees is neither true justice nor what compassion and mercy require. I must err on the side of caution in the cause of protecting that which I'm charged to protect. But where I can, where the chance exists, I'll grant that mercy whenever and however I may. I won't be able to do that as often as I wish, or as often as you could wish, but I'll do it as often as I can, and I'll ask God's help to live with the many times when I cannot." A ripping sound had been loud in the stillness, as Edward Seahamper tore open Spinesir Arnold's sleeve and applied a dressing of Fleming moss from the emergency case each of her Imperial Guardsmen carried at his belt. She had looked down, watching her secretary's pale face as the bandage was adjusted, then cocked her head at him. "Can you continue, Spinter?" she had asked him, and Arnald's hadn't been the only eyebrow which rose in astonishment at her question.
"Yes. I mean, of course, Your Majesty. If that's your wish," he had said after a moment.
"Of course it's my wish," she had replied with a crooked smile, that elbow and upper arm still pressed against her ribs. She had sat very erect, but she had also sat very still, and Garvais suspected it had hurt her to breathe. Yet if that were so, she had allowed no sign of it to cross her expression or shadow her voice. "We have much still to do today," she told her secretary, her eyes rising across the puddle of her assailant's blood, to include the gathered witnesses in the same statement. "If we refuse to let Clintan and the group of four stop us, then we won't allow this to either. Let us proceed." And proceed she had, Corin Garvey thought now. For another 4 hours, until lunch. She had seemed unaware her hair was steadily tumbling into looser and looser falls about her shoulders, just as she had seemed unaware when Merlin Athroyes picked up the crown which had fallen from her head, and stood holding it in the crook of his left arm like a paladin's helmet. There had been the slightest, barely perceptible breathlessness in her voice, like a catch of pain, yet it was so faint Garvey suspected most of those watching her never heard it at all. 17 more people were sent to execution that morning, but another 6 were pardoned, and in each case Empress Charlian, still without notes, had recited the extenuating circumstances which led her to grant mercy in those cases. She had continued unhurriedly, calmly, as if no one had ever attempted to harm her at all, and by the end of that morning she had held that audience of Coruscantian witnesses in the palm of one slender hand. The bell announcing the end of the morning session had sounded at last, and the Empress had looked up with a wry smile. "We trust no one will be disappointed if we adjourn for the day at this time," she had said. "Under the circumstances, we believe it might be excusable." There had actually been an answering mutter of laughter, and her smile had grown broader. "We'll take that as agreement," she had told them, and stood. She had stepped down from the dais, and Garvey's eyes had narrowed as she took Merlin Athroy's left arm. She had swayed slightly, and her nostrils had looked pinched as she had seemed to stumble for a moment. Her elbow had still pressed against her ribs, and there had been a certain fragility to her normally graceful carriage. Yet she had smiled graciously at him and at the others who bowed as she passed them. And then she had been gone.